The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 426 for Sunday, November 25th, 2012.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, you send in your cool stuff found. We answer your questions. We share your tips. We share our tips. We pile up the cool stuff found for the next show. And we'll explain a little more about that later on in this show. And all together, we try to learn something new each and every time we come here. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in increasingly chilly Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing, John?
I'm chilly. Well, actually, I'm not. No, I turned the heat up.
Oh, that's good.
I came into the office, or what I like to call the office.
Yeah. I came into the studio and, you know, I have a...
Oh, you have a studio. You know, maybe I'll call this a... No, I can't call it a studio.
Well, this is actually, I mean, this is, you know, this is like a rehearsal studio and a recording.
Oh, I know. You have you have musical instruments.
And
you can call it a studio.
Yeah. And Arlex tiles on the walls and, you know, and it's soundproofed and everything. But anyway, I have a programmable thermostat in here, but it's, I got to set it to come on a little earlier because it's only like 56 right now. But anyway, hey, good news. My throat is feeling like 1,000% better. This past week, I crossed the, I don't know, whatever threshold it was that I needed to cross. And it's still not perfect, but feeling way better.
Quite as raspy.
Yeah, it's feeling good. I made it through a gig on Friday night. But anyway.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Oh, so you, all right, but you're taking your medicine. And
Yeah. So it's good. Let's just get right into the show. Let's, we've got lots of stuff to tell you about. This will be, we will not be recording next week because I'm going to be away. We'll talk a little bit about what we're going to do, but, we will be back on December 9th. So for those of you, you can savor this hopefully between now and then. Kevin writes, the App Store license allows you to use an app on all household machines you personally have control of. And we're talking about the Mac App Store license. It says, I originally had iPhoto 8 and decided to upgrade after I moved to Mountain Lion and upgraded / bought iPhoto 11. The download is currently going, but it is over 1 gig in size and I have 3 machines to install it on. I'm aware that using the App Store on each machine will allow me to re-download it for each machine, but I would prefer not to unnecessarily use another 3 gigs of bandwidth for just one gig file. My question is there any way to copy the app between computers, either by sneakernet or over my LAN? Could I just copy the app across between applications folders? Hopefully you can help prevent me from going through beating up my ISP. Actually, Kevin, that you can do that. It just works. You copy the app from one Mac to the other and in my experience, you are good to go. Now, if that Mac had not been signed in, if the Mac App Store on that Mac to which you were copying it had not been signed into your account, you may be prompted to sign in. But I don't even know if that's going to happen. But it definitely will work copying from one Mac to the other. So, yeah, you can just download it to one. And that's the nice part about, you know, the application bundles that we live with here on the Mac is that certainly anything you get from the Mac App Store is going to be just one bundle. So if you go into the applications folder and copy it from there, you can copy it. Like you said, if you want to use sneakernet and copy it to a USB stick and then just walk it to the other Mac, that's fine. Or of course you can do it across your local area network if you're so inclined and you desire to do it. So it's good stuff.
So that's the technical aspect of it, Dave.
Yeah.
And I did find a little ditty here from this Jason Snell guy. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I like Jason. He's a good friend of mine.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Okay.
Yeah, he writes for this Mac publication. I can't remember which one. I've met him too, but and he writes good stuff. But I did find a Macworld article from our friend Jason, and it does make some commentary here. Now, while what you say is technically correct, Dave, he does bring up some interesting points here in an article called Mac App Store Licensing and Copy Protection Explained. And so while you can certainly technically do this, Well, you just got to read the license agreement.
Okay.
I believe normally you're allowed to install up to 5 machines, I think, is typically the limit and stuff like that legally. But there's nothing technically, except for one thing he mentions, but a lot of people don't do this, is that apps can phone home if they'd like to. I guess that's the choice of the app developer.
Right.
And ask for authentication or some other means of authenticating yourself and saying that you're a legitimate owner of that software. But it seems a lot of programs don't. In that what you say is for the most part true, is that you can. And I think part of that also has to do with what I guess their insistence was on sandboxing, which is that the app should be self-contained. So if you copy it, everything should work as expected, whereas traditional apps, that may not be the case.
That's right. Depending on how it was built, but that's right. Yeah. Anything that comes from the Mac App Store is just going to be that one bundle. It's not going to, it may, once it runs, create its own sandbox container. But even that is just temporary data or preference data, and not anything required to run the app. And, you know, that does bring up a good opportunity for a reminder. We have all become used to troubleshooting. If there's a problem with an app and you want to go and muck with the preferences or what have you for that app, we all learned to go into our home folder, our library folder, and then into application support. And then find the folder for the app and either delete the entire folder for the app or go in and pick out bits and pieces of that. And likewise, if we wanted to delete an app's preferences, we all had learned to go into home library preferences and remove the preferences for that app there. However, now that we are in the land of apps potentially, but not always, being sandboxed, that's not the case. If they are sandboxed, and this includes not only third-party apps that come from the Mac App Store, but also like mail from Apple, there's a lot of data that's not stored in what we would consider the normal places. It is now stored in the home library containers folder. And then within that, you'll find folders for each sandboxed app. And then within that, so if you go into home library containers and then say com.apple.mail, you'll find a data folder, and inside the data folder, then you'll find another library folder and another application support folder and another preferences folder. And that's where all that stuff is. So it sort of mimics the hierarchy that we were used to seeing without the container, but the container allows that hierarchy to exist, but it is sandboxed, meaning only that app is allowed to go and monkey with any of the data in there. So just a good reminder. Because I get caught by it sometimes. I'm troubleshooting. It's like, where is that mail preferences? Oh, yeah, that's right. Continue. Huh. Yeah.
I did, you know.
We've talked about it, but I always forget it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I do too.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you reminded me because I looked, and yeah, so I see Ambrosia SW, Snaps Pro, which they finally released a new version that works with Mountain Lion. Thank you.
Yeah.
And a few other apps in here. Actually, it's most of the other things I see in here are Preview, Text Edit, and Photo Stream. So other than that's kind of weird, at least in this one machine, that all I see is Ambrosia and Apple in the containers folder.
Yeah, I see Growl and Agile Bits because I use Growl and 1Password. So you must not have updated to the new version of Growl, John.
Well, actually, this is, you know, it could be because this is on my 7 machine.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Which has the app store, but maybe it's not fully implemented, or I'm probably not using as many apps from the app store on here as I am on my newer machine. Okay. Yeah. Or newer OS.
Right.
Because oddly enough, I have the newer OS on the older machine. Go figure that out. All right.
I'll try and figure it out. In the meanwhile, we'll answer Graham's question. Graham writes, my Google fingers seem to be failing on this one. If one has a Gmail account set up on an iPhone and a particular folder seems to not contain all the messages it should, even after doing the drag down until the bubble pops thing, is there any way to force a dialogue along the lines of don't give me a differential status, just give me everything you have, other than deleting and re-adding the whole account? So this is interesting. It's good in that it falls into the category of this doesn't happen to me. And by good, I mean that it shouldn't happen to you, which means in theory, at least there's a solution somewhere. One thing I've found with Mail App, and this is again just sort of general troubleshooting, but might help you, Grim, is that it sometimes gets stuck between checks. Are you, is that noise on your end, John? I guess it is.
Yeah, I just told to stop.
Okay. Mail sometimes gets stuck for me between checks, which means, it's trying to check. And this usually happens as I'm on like a weak cellular connection or, potentially, you know, moving from Wi-Fi to cellular or what have you. And it never seems to be able to recover from this. Hours later, it'll still be stuck, you know, not being able to check mail. And the only way that I can get it to actually check is to quit mail, to force quit it. Now, the easy way, well, the way I typically do it is to go out of the app, so back to the home screen, and then hold down on any app to get that to get us into jiggly mode. Hang on, why isn't it doing this right? So I double tap on the home button first, and then I hold down on say mail or any app down there in the trough, and then I hit the little minus sign on mail. That kills it off, and then you can relaunch it, and oftentimes that will fix this sort of refresh of that particular mailbox. That's the best way I know of to get this to happen. Have you ever experienced it, John?
Not real. I'm trying to remember where the heck is it now? Is it in notifications? But there is a place where you can set your notification method. I'm trying to remember where it is.
This isn't so much notifications. This is just actually checking mail.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I know that now, one thing I can mention that there's two views of mail. There's inboxes and accounts. Sometimes I found that I have to go to accounts in order to access things that are not otherwise visible. If I go to the inboxes section in mailboxes on an iOS device, or at least on my iPhone 4. So yeah, no, I mean, doing the, the stretchy thing it should be initiating a check for new stuff. So,
right. Yeah. It like I said, for me, if it gets stuck in the middle, it doesn't work. While we're talking about force quitting apps, there is another way of force quitting an iOS app. And of course, the way I just described, you have to be out of the app to force quit it, because if you're trying to quit from the system trough there, it doesn't work because the app's not there. If you're in it, it's the active app. So the way to quit an active app, and this is really handy if you have an app that's stuck that you can't get out of, that you'd otherwise need to reboot your phone, is you actually start down the process of rebooting your phone. You press and hold the power button at the top of the device, right? And wait until that slide to power off thing appears, then release the power button and press and hold the home button. And after a few minutes, sorry, after a few seconds, most likely, let me try this here. So I'm in power off mode. Now I move and I hold the home button and
look at that.
Yep. You hold that for a couple of seconds and then it will bring you back to the home screen and you'll see your app quit. So that's a way to force quit an app that's stuck, or to force quit the app that you're in if you want to do it that way. So that's just handy little tidbits. You know, there's a good Lifehacker article that describes that we will put in the show notes. But
wow, that's a really good secret handshake, because typically what I'll do is just hit the home button, where of course you're at the main screen, then do the double tap and then you'll get the, can get to the jiggly mode.
Right.
But no, I like that one. That's a...
Yeah, well, I'm trying to,
another way of getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to add as much as we can here, because we're going to be gone for 2 weeks.
Well, you know what I found lately, Dave, though, is that I don't know what it is. I've actually been noticing now either. I mean, I've had this phone for about 2 years now, but I've been noticing that more often than not, if I leave it sitting, I usually leave it sitting on the nightstand. Then I'll wake up and the battery will be dead. Now, I know the battery, like any rechargeable battery, dies, but it just seems that sometimes if I quit all my apps, now some people will shake their fist and say, well, that's not the way iOS is supposed to work. But I've noticed that if I have apps, even if they're not actively running, but they do things, you know, like navigation and other things, I don't know, but it just seems if I have a lot of apps running and I, you know, just hit the power button to kind of, you know, really sleep it rather than, you know, totally shut it off, the battery will be drained in the morning.
Yep.
And I, you know, I would expect that any iPhone battery, because of its size, should last you, you know, at least a day.
Yeah.
But I found a lot of times that's not the case, especially if they're apps which I think are doing secret things in the background and probably chewing either Wi-Fi or 3G bandwidth. And I think those are the two biggest offenders as far as things that will run your battery down quicker than you expect is data access, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right.
Now, I've just noticed that. I think I gotta gauge this, but I think I'm considering a do-it-yourself battery replacement for this thing. I mean, does it sound right to you that...
Well,
you know, I mean, I've had it. Well, I got this phone pretty much when it came out, and I think it's been out for about 2 years, right? So, yeah, I mean, would you expect this?
Yeah.
Would you expect this battery to be? Because I charge and recharge like crazy, almost daily. So I think
your battery should still be kicking butt, actually. Because I bought iPhone 4 the day it came out. I of course replaced it with the 4S because I'm crazy, and then replaced that with the 5. But the 4 has remained in service since the day that I bought it. It moved first to my wife, and now my son, who was on the show last week, has that iPhone 4. So, and it's still the battery. He is the envy of the household because the iPhone 4. it had the best battery life because it had a big honking space for a battery in there. It didn't have the, you know, the dual core stuff that we brought in with the 4S. And the 5, so, you know, it's not chewing the battery. He can go days without needing to charge, and all of us kind of have to, you know, if we don't charge every day, we're scrambling by the end of day two. So, but what I will point out to you is something that we talked about shortly after I got my iPhone 5, and that is that you can see what apps are using the navigation or whatever in the background. And you can get logs about this by going to settings, general, about, and then at the bottom of that, second from the bottom, you'll see diagnostics and usage. If you turn on automatically send, then you get at the bottom of that window, diagnostics and usage data. And you'll get all kinds of different things in here. But the one that was handy to me were the daily AWDD logs. And by looking at those, I started to notice what you're looking for is bundle ID, and it's a mess reading through this, of course, but you'll see that there's different apps that show
AWDD. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
And you'll see that there's different apps that show up in there. And of course, com.apple.whatever apps are Apple apps. But if you see somebody else, then take a look. And it could be, you know, like, say, Instagram, right, that wants to know your location. And as long as the times match up and you say, yeah, that's reasonable that Instagram checked my location, then it's not a problem. But like I said, I found one app that I hadn't even launched on my iPhone 5 ever, but it had just moved onto it via my backup restore. And it was checking location, you know, every 10, 15 minutes. And it made a huge difference in my battery just removing it. So anyway,
look at these messages. Oh, they have things like sys mode CDMA and wow. Yeah, this is geeky stuff.
It's really geeky.
And then also, and also in our chat room, which if you don't know about our chat room, because I don't think we talked about it, Dave.
No, that's right.
If you'd like to know about it.
Say hi to everybody in the chat room, John.
So how do you get to the chat room, which is Dave and I put together something extra for you all. Y'all. Which is, I think it's www.macgeekapp.com/stream.
Correct. Dave? Yeah, that's right.
Ah, good. So you go there, you can not only listen to us
while we record the show live.
Interact with us but you can interact with us using IRC, which has been around forever, at least as long as I can recall.
Yeah. It might be older than us, John. I don't know.
Excellent. But not allowed to chat on app says. Is that, I guess that's his handle. But he said something good, which is a review your settings and location services, which is certainly a good thing, is that location services, as I suggested, is something that can take up. Well, I guess the GPS circuitry is doing that. So if you don't want or need an app to know where you are, then go into location services and shut it off, which I'll do occasionally for the camera, just because with the camera app, if you take a picture and location services are on, it will embed your location, which you may or may not want.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So yeah, there's two reasons to turn off location. If you don't want it, and also if you don't need it, it can save your battery. Cool. Yeah. So, all right. Steven has a tip while we're in tip mode. He said, I wanted to mention this a few shows back since the topic came up again recently in show 425. Here's what I use to quickly send a link to a web page from Safari. Simply hit Command Shift I from the page you want to send, and this will fire up Mail App and start a new message with the link right in there. So it says you can also use Command I to send the full page instead of a link. Good stuff. He says when you go to the file menu in Safari and hover your mouse over the share entry to get the flyout menu, press the shift key to see the email. This page entry becomes email link to this page. And that's where that shortcut lives. So you have file, share, and then the shift key changes it from email this page to email link to this page. So it's good stuff.
Or if you're on the prior, because I'm looking.
Oh, that's right.
On my, I'm looking now on my machine running. So let's go about Safari 602 on my older OS machine, Dave.
Yep.
Because I want to maintain at least a version back, because I know not all our listeners are hip, cool cats and want to install the latest thing. But in the file menu on this version of Safari, it actually, because, you know, I was wondering that. I didn't see it explicitly on my Mountain Lion machine on Safari, but I did see it on the one on my that's in front of me right now, and it has mail contents of this page, because I'm like, how what wizardry was used to find this key combination, because normally it should be in one of the menus expressed here, and at least in the file menu here it says mail contents of this page or mail link to this page. I think it's pointed out if you hold down, well, no, shift does nothing for those, but I don't see those on my other machine, Dave.
Interesting. Yeah. So,
no. Okay, it's a share submenu. Okay,
in Mountain Lion or current version of Safari, it's a share submenu. Yeah.
Oh, and then it has not only email but message, Twitter, and Facebook. Look at that.
Right.
Slick.
Right. Yavo.
All right, now.
And you know, if you want to add your own keyboard shortcuts to that menu, say you want to share to Twitter with a keyboard shortcut, a web page to Twitter, you can do that. You can go to the, I'm flying without a net here, John, but you can go to the keyboard system preference pane, right? And go to application shortcuts. And then you can click the plus key there. And if you only want to add this shortcut for Safari, which you probably do, you choose Safari from the application dropdown. And then you go to the menu title. So this is going to be, I believe the menu title of this is just going to be Twitter. And so you type in, and it seems strange, but you actually type in Twitter. And I'm going to test this to make sure this works, because like I said, we're flying without a net. So we're typing the Twitter command, and then I'm going to make it command option T. And we'll see if that works. And so I say add. And now I go back to Safari and I look in the share menu, and sure enough, command option T now lives to the right of Twitter in that menu. And if I say command option T, boom, it comes up and tells me, of course, I have no Twitter account configured on this Mac, but had I a Twitter account configured on this particular Mac, it would work brilliantly. So that's how you do that too. It's all about the extra stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a general rule of life. It's always about the extra stuff. Mm-hmm. Never settle for just the standard package. You want to get the extra stuff.
That's right. Speaking of never settling, John, listener John, has a question about sound, and I'm curious as to where we take this one. You want to start with it, John?
I will start with it, because this is fascinating to me.
Go.
Kind of. Well, whatever. So John says, happy Thanksgiving. And yes, it was a good Thanksgiving. Much was eaten and discussed and all that. Anyways, as I sit here working with nothing to do, belly full and fighting the urge to disappear and take a nap, I figured I'd knock off some of the things I've been meaning to get for the past few months. Here's my problem. Our iMac is located in the great room. Our TV is also located in that room. Whenever our kids are on the iMac, they're annoying us with system sounds, music, etc. while we're watching TV. We'd like to be able to disable sounds on the guest account, if possible, to eliminate this annoyance. Is it possible? And if so, how? So, maybe as the last part of the discussion, Dave, I think this is a it could be a parenting or child management issue. Mm-hmm. But let's take it from the technological point of view here.
Sure.
First, because, well, that's what we're good at.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Family. Yeah. So obviously number one here, maybe not obviously, but if you don't know about this, there are a couple of ways on the Mac, the default ways to shut off the sound. One is through the OS. So if you go to System Preferences Sound, you will see, and then you will see some sub tabs here, and either in the output or the sound effects section, you will see on the bottom, it lets you set the output volume, and there is a little box. Mute. Well, if you check that box, that will mute the sound. You should not hear any sounds from anything if you do that. Number two, depending on the type of keyboard you have, you can also engage mute mode, which I think is typically F10, or there's either a special key, because I'm looking at two different keyboards right now and I see two different options. So there's a quick way to do it through the keyboard. Now, depending on the level of cleverness of the young whippersnappers that are playing with the machine, they may be able to defeat this quite easily by basically watching you and just doing what you did, because it'll reverse it.
Or hitting the volume buttons on the keyboard, right?
Right. So right. The volume buttons will re-enable sound. Yes, correct. Or I think hitting the mute key. So right now, if I hit the mute key, all right, I'm muted. Yeah, so you're correct. Now, we're going to get hardcore here, Dave, or I'm going to get hardcore, because here's the way you could, and then I don't know if we're going to talk about the parenting aspect here.
No, I have some other places to take this.
Because I'd just be like, hey, will you kids just turn that down? But, you know, we're solving technology problems. Right. The other way, and this extends to a lot of things here. And so warning, warning, danger, danger. This gets dangerous because you're mucking about with the OS. But I did find some articles that suggested, and I've done this in the past as well. If there's a piece of hardware, and that's why I said, Dave, this question may dovetail into other questions about disabling hardware.
Okay.
Basically, the way that Mac OS maps what the hardware can do to what the software can take advantage of is a kernel extension. And where are those stored, you may ask? Well, they're stored in /system/library/extensions for the most part. Say that three times fast. So in this case, if you go into that folder, now, number one, if you're going to the extensions folder and changing anything, please make a backup of whatever you're going to muck with. So, but once you do make a copy of whatever it is, then what you may want to try, and again, this is getting extreme, but it's going to keep those whippersnappers from figuring it out, or at least slow them down, is there's a extension called ioaudiofamily.kext, K-E-X-T being kernel extension, and there may also be one called ioaudio2family.kext. And as far as I can tell, if you remove those kernel extensions, your Mac will then lose the ability to communicate with the sound hardware. Because that kernel extension is the link between the hardware and the OS to make sound. So, give that a shot.
I think if you're going to do
it's
that.
It's extreme. And again, be cautious, because I just found references to it. And I'm like, you know, that kind of makes sense from a technology standpoint in that these are the files that link the hardware and software. So why not remove them and see what happens? But, you know, be careful. Make a backup. If you're going to mess with anything in the kernel extensions folder or the extensions folder, because for the most part, what's in there is stuff from the Mac OS, but third parties may install things there as well, which sometimes you may need to get to and maybe even remove if things start misbehaving. So that's why I'm gingerly pointing people to looking in here and perhaps removing things to address issues.
So I found an Apple support discussion article forum thread about this. And they recommend, they actually, somebody said that they did this and they had to remove more than just the IO audio family kext.
Oh,
or they did remove more than that. Now, whether they had to or not remains to be seen. But the other thing they found they had to do was you have to rebuild the kernel extension cache before, or commonly referred to as the kext cache, before this will take effect. Now, most of the time, rebooting after changing the extensions folder would force this, but you can also...
And I've seen that in the console. A lot of times, if I made changes to kernel extensions, when I reboot and look in the console, it'll say, oh, well, what's cached and what's there doesn't match, so I'm going to rebuild the cache for you, okay? And it kind of does it.
Yeah.
I think that's what should happen.
It should. You can force it, though, with something like Onyx, which will allow you to remove the kext cache, and then it will rebuild it. So that's one way of doing it. There are others. I want to mention, actually, both Shabden and Julian in the chat room had the same idea. Plug either a pair of headphones or just an audio jack, you know, snip off the cord from an old broken pair of earphones and just plug the audio jack into your Mac's sound output port. That will disable the speakers. Now, again, the kids could just pull the thing out and now the problem is solved.
But electrically that's happening. So electrically, if you insert something into the headphone or sound output jack, on pretty much any Mac, I think it will disable the internal speakers. So
it used to be a hardware thing. It years ago, you could actually have the internal speakers and a headphone going simultaneously if you knew the kind of the magic way of doing it. But now it is impossible via hardware to do that. So that will do it. Another thing that you can do is if you go into System Preferences, you can go to sound and you can choose another sound output device. Now it's possible that you only have one sound output device because that's what your Mac is all your Mac has.
Yeah. So I see headphones on my mini and that's it.
Right. Because you have headphones plugged in. Now, if you unplugged headphones, it would say nothing because you don't have, you don't have speakers in the mini. Right.
There's an internal speaker in there.
Is there an internal speaker in the mini? Okay. So it would move back to internal
All I know is when I restart it I hear a chime and it's not. If I'm unplugged, I'm almost positive there's a speaker in there. Anyways, but besides the point.
So if you don't have another device to. Another audio device to route the sound to, you could create one or install one. And something called SoundFlower is probably the easiest thing to install. It's actually a way of routing audio in different paths, but SoundFlower will work for this purpose. If you just set the output device to SoundFlower, then the sound will not go to the speakers. And so that's another way of doing it. As Bruce though points out in the chat room, the question here is not about disabling the sound system wide. It is about disabling the sound in the, guest account only. Now, the guest account's an interesting account because you can't set startup items for it. So it's very difficult to do anything on a per account basis there. However, if you create a kids account, then you can set startup items. And one of the things that you could set would be something like, say, Audio Hijack Pro. And you could have Audio Hijack hijack all system sounds and just mute them. And that way, no matter what the kids do with the volume knob, it would mute the sound. Now, of course, they'd see Audio Hijack Pro running and they might just quit it. And then, of course, that would mitigate their issue, but that's yet another way to do it. Would be to do it via software. And one final way to do it via software, I think parental controls gives you the ability to control sound. So that would certainly be something to look into.
You know, I looked through that, Dave, and as far as I could tell, there was not a spit, which surprised me because it does seem to be something you'd want to be able to set. But no, I looked through it because the guest account actually lets you set parental controls on it if you want to.
Right.
No, right. I looked through that. No, I was thinking that. I'm like, oh, this is the way to do it. Parental controls will, you know, cut out all that damn noise. But I didn't see an explicit option. I may have missed it, but I didn't see anything in parental controls that would let you control that. Though there's a wealth of things in parental controls that it will let you
okay. control.
And actually, I was impressed, you know, as far as, you know, websites you can go to and logging and all sorts of stuff. And I don't know. I would guess you're probably past the point right now, Dave, where you implement parental controls.
No.
Technologically.
Yeah. The only real parental control that I've ever implemented is using OpenDNS to keep, frankly, to keep the kids from accidentally stumbling onto, you know, porn sites or
the whatever. Filth, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And OpenDNS has worked flawlessly for us for that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. Do they actually have an explicit option? Like, you know, do not resolve, you know, adult material.
Yeah. Yeah. You okay. can totally.
So it'll just come up. It'll just fail, right?
Yeah.
It just won't go to the site.
It comes back and says your administrator has, this site is categorized as whatever adult content, your administrator has disabled that. And that's that.
Yeah. And if it's that important, then someone would come to you.
That's right.
The administrator.
Yes.
And say, yes, I'd like to get to this site.
Yeah. And we've seen that where there's been some, you know, stuff they're looking at for school that's miscategorized or whatever. And you can whitelist domains or blacklist domains.
Oh,
Open DNS is great for that. Yeah. Yeah. It's good. I highly recommend it for anyone, even if you're not looking to specifically, you know, block porn or whatever.
Cool.
It's good. Yeah.
Or, and then, you know, the other part of this, it may not be appropriate, but, you know, restructure the or just yell at those kids. I mean, come on. Doesn't that work?
No. Yelling at them
never
works.
Noise. They're making noise, so you yell at them to stop making noise.
Good luck.
That doesn't work?
Good luck.
No, I know.
All right. You know, we had a question from another John, and he asks, let me see if I can.
Like this one.
Yeah.
I don't think I answered it. I wanted to, but I think it's great for a discussion.
He asks, I'd love to hear a discussion about, number one, how to shop and recognize better quality external hard drives. Are there regular quality and premium quality hard drives for consumers to buy? And number two, is there a rule of thumb that you or the hard drive industry uses as when it is smart to replace a hard drive to reduce the chance of failure? 2 years, 3 years, or is there some other metric that you use? So in essence, what he's asking with question number one is, how do geeks, i.e. us, shop for hard drives? And I'll kick it off here, but really, you know, I don't think there's anything special that I do, but I will explain the process because I've been through it a lot. I first figure out, obviously, how big of a drive I need and whether or not I care more about volume, like the actual sound, the amount of noise that comes out of the drive, whether I care about speed. I figure out what my priorities are for this drive. And then, of course, size and price, right? Because, you know, you kind of get to have maybe two, but not everything. So if I, you know, if I'm looking for a drive that's going to be near, like you said, in your TV room or maybe near your television or whatever, somewhere where you're going to hear it all the time, I might not want to go with, you know, a 10,000 RPM drive or a 7,200 RPM drive. I may want to go with something 5,400, but even then I will look at specs and make sure the decibels on it are low. And for an external hard drive, whether or not the enclosure has a fan in it is going to make a big difference for me in that regard. Because you can get away with using an enclosure that doesn't have a fan. And obviously that saves you noise. So that's, you know, number one. If I want speed and that's a priority, well, then I'm probably actually looking at something much, much quieter in an SSD. But if, you know, again, if price factors into that, then I might go, you know, for a 7,200 or even a 10,000 RPM drive, because those are going to allow me to get more raw speed out of them. And then, of course, size. I look for size, you know, whatever size I need. Always as big as I can possibly get, because I know I'm going to need more down the road. But as far as manufacturers go, that's really where it comes down to for me. Once I've kind of pulled all the factors together, I've had good luck with Seagate drives. I've had good luck with Western Digital drives. Hitachi drives have always been kind of flaky for me in my experience, but you know, I'm one guy. So I've seen a lot of drives out there. I've also warrantied quite a few hard drives in my day for both myself and customers, and Seagate and WD have been fantastic with warranties. They're really, really fast and not a whole lot of headache in convincing them. Yeah, I need you to swap this out. So that's sort of my thing, John. How do you shop for hard drives? You do anything different than I do?
I think I may, in that. So part of the research for hard drives. So the question was, or I think the basis of the question, let me bring up the question in front of me here. Okay. But you know, is there a way to differentiate or better quality? Okay. So this is the thing. And I will offer this, David, I think you've dealt this too, because you've worked in the enterprise space. So I would say that yes, there are different classes of hard drives. So if you look at the various vendors, they do have hard drives that they claim are enterprise class. And from what I've seen on this, now you got to look at the specs though. And it's not for everyone, because they, you know, they can get very technical and there's a lot of gobbledygook, but basically there is a metric called MTBF, mean time between failures, that a manufacturer of pretty much anything can specify, saying, okay, well, you know, based on the technology we're using, and well, basically that's it. I mean, there's all sorts of different technology, either software, electrical. Well, in this case, it's more mechanical, I think, or SSDs. It's more the flash memory. Is what based on, you know, using hopefully an industry standard measurement, do you expect to be the time between failures? And again, it's mean time between failures, MTBF. Some manufacturers specify this. They also may for enterprise level things. And I've searched for this. So you can search for enterprise drives and you will find various vendors will say, well, these are what we consider enterprise drives. And those are meant for applications, heavy duty applications that, you know, a home user may not typically be doing. Whether it's being on 24/7. And I think that's for the most part what a lot of these drives. So a lot of these drives where they say they're enterprise drives, it's probably in a data center in a nice computer room and the drive's on all the time. So they give this rating, and then, you know, so they do tests and they simulate, you know, beating on the drive and say, okay, well, you know, after 10,000 or 20,000 or whatever hours, you may expect this drive to fail. The other thing I would add to this is that you want to use a technology. So the thing is, any drive, whether it be mechanical or SSD, will eventually fail, as will everything that you own.
Right.
Sorry to break the news to you, but everything, not just your computer, but everything will fail eventually. But you want to use a tool to try to help you avoid failure, because failure is upsetting. So number one, of course, as Dave and I suggest time and time again, make backups. But number two, you may want to use something that can proactively or somewhat proactively tell you that something may be wrong. Now, the one, and actually I just ran into this the other day, Dave, is that I took an older drive that I put in an external enclosure to do an aperture backup. And when I plugged it in, I heard tick, 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 tick.
That's a bad sound.
Yeah, from a hard drive, especially when it went away and then it worked again. It's like, oh boy, this is like on the edge. So I may want to take this specimen and study it further.
Yeah.
So one is, if your hard drive makes the clicking noise, at least mechanical drives, that means, okay, it's probably about to die. but also there are utilities or technologies that can help you avoid this. So, or learn about this. So number one, yeah, the audio signal, that's the most severe. Number two, you could get something like Smart Reporter. Smart is a technology where the drive will make a very good attempt to tell you about things that are going wrong with it, but you need a utility. Well, Apple's utilities will report the smart status of a drive, like System Info, but or you can get something like Smart Reporter, which I really like, and it'll email you if something's wrong. The other thing is to maybe use something which I really like, Dave, is, you know, we love a lot of, you know, the utilities guys make. But ProSoft makes something called Drive Genius, and it has a sub utility called Drive Pulse that will do a number of things on a regular basis, semi-regular basis, or a regular basis on the drive. It'll do a surface scan, it'll do an integrity check, and a few other things that can let you know ahead of time, okay, maybe this drive is starting to die. before it just dies. So I guess my suggestions are, again, to summarize. So number one, there are enterprise drives. If you want to pay the extra money and get the extended warranty or better reliability, you can do that. And number two, always make backups. Number three, get some utilities that will try to warn you that something bad will happen. But they can only go so far.
Yeah, I just one last thing. Brother. Yeah, one last thing to add. I have not found in my experience, limited or not, that the MTBF ratings really mean anything to me.
Okay.
Well, only because there's so many different, we all use drives in different ways, right? You know, and we sleep our drives at different times, and we, you know, we store data on them differently, and we beat on them differently. And so I've just found, I mean, I've had some drives that, you know, that were rated to last much less than others, and they lasted longer. You know, it's hard to predict with any degree of accuracy how long a drive is going to last you. So really the best thing to do is to make backups, use something like Smart Reporter or Drive Pulse or something that monitors the status on your drive so that you get some advanced warning, because it's easier to replace it when you know it's going to fail before it has actually failed. And then just, you know, just live with it. And use it either until it dies or until you know it's about to die, and then abandon it and move on. That's what I do. And it really is the best way to, you know, trying to predict, it's just not going to work. If you've got racks of servers, over time, you're going to be able to figure out, okay, we know how we beat up our drives. And we know that, you know, after 4 years, this drive, you know, these types of drives are going to start to fail. So in that sense, sure, you can start to be proactive about it because it's actually worth your while to do that. But for us at home where we've got, you know, no more than, I mean, even if you have 10 hard drives going at once, there's no real way to tell. You don't have enough data for your usage patterns to tell you. So that's.
Well, and to wrap this up.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
But the other thing
up.
I'd mention, and you know, my first introduction to this, so working in an enterprise environment, I did have encounters with RAID. So RAID, as you may or may not know, but RAID is a technology that will either give you increased speed or increased reliability or both, which is ideal. So RAID is another thing you may want to consider. Apple offers it in this utility. Third-party vendors like Drobo and what's the one you got, Dave? Synology?
Yeah, Synology. Yep.
Yeah, or other people offer enclosures that will offer protection. So if a drive just rolls over and dies immediately, if you're using a certain flavor of RAID, it'll cost you time, but the data will not be lost in theory, assuming RAID is working correctly. Same with the Drobo. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Right.
So that's another thing to consider, even though in the past it's, you know, been kind of something for mostly the you know, enterprise geeks building RAID arrays. You know, Drobo and Synology and these other guys, I think, have brought it to the consumer space where it may make sense because, you know, the thing you got to ask yourself is how important is that data? I mean, if it's,
yeah.
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's photos or documents or, you know, financial or whatever stuff, then yeah, that's probably pretty darn important. You may want to invest in getting something beyond a simple single hard drive to store your data because, again, things will fail. Yep. So.
Cool. And I want to mention very, very quickly, you know, we talked about the Drobo 5D, but.
I'm really
excited about is the Drobo 5N. Yeah. And they had told me about
it stands for
network.
Yeah. I heard about it too. When I stopped by, I'm like, so what's new? And they're like, well, something in the network space.
Yeah.
But continue.
The cat's out of the bag now, and it's actually going to be announced, like pricing, and you can pre-order and all that stuff. I think on December 4th or something or 6th, sometime, I think. I hope I'm not blowing anything for him there, but I don't think I am. I don't know. Sometime soon they're going to have pre-announcements, pre-release information. But anyway, so yeah, the Drobo 5N, it's good stuff. I'm really curious to see how much better they've made it than the the FS, because the FS had really slow networking software in it. And so, and I'm really curious to see it. So hopefully by the time I get back from vacation, we might as well talk about this. The reason we are not recording next week is because I'm going to be traveling. In fact, I'm going to be traveling from basically next Saturday, the 1st through the 9th. And on the 9th, we have a crazy plan. I will wake up in Miami aboard Royal Caribbean's Allure of the Seas, which I believe, John, is still the biggest cruise ship at sea at the moment. So that'll be interesting. But anyway, we'll end our vacation that day. We'll go to the airport. We'll fly home that night. And this will be it. We're pushing to the later time slot that we'll mostly avoid, but it will be the 8:30 p.m. Sunday night, December 9th. For those of you that care about the live stream, we will be doing the show. Obviously, I will have no opportunity whatsoever to prepare for that show during the week leading up to it because I won't have internet access. However, we have been stockpiling Cool Stuff Found for a long time. And so that night is going to be the Cool Stuff Found blowout, which I think will be a perfect thing for us to do. So that will be Mackie Geb 427 on Sunday, December 9th. So assuming all travel, you know, things, assuming the stars align, but we should be home in time to do that. But that's the plan anyway. Mm-hmm. All right. We've got a good question from Gray. And then I also, during the show, I want to talk
about... That's where I wanted to go.
I want to talk about this iPad mini here, but let's do Gray. Let's do Gray quickly, and or maybe not quickly. I don't know. But it is a good it is a good email. Good question. Gray says, my wife has begun to receive daily email notifications detailing delays in delivery of messages that she didn't send. The body of the message is obviously spam. The recipient email address is bogus, clearly, as well. I attached an example, which, of course, he showed us, and he says it's rejected by the server to which it is being sent. I'm becoming frustrated by this. I've scanned my wife's computer with Norton antivirus, which found nothing. OK, so the short answer is there's nothing you can do about this. The second half of the shorter answer is there's nothing you did to cause this either. Chances are.
Well, no, there was.
Chances
what
are
you did what you did to cause this is you have an email address.
That's right. Yeah. All someone has done. Right. So these spammers go out there and harvest email addresses to both send email to, but also to send it from. It is very, very trivial to spoof the address from which an email comes. You can do it too. Just create a mail account on your Mac and put in someone else's address as the from address. It's like super, super simple. And then you can send email from them. But it'll be tracked. If you look at the headers of the message, you could see that it came from the IP address that you're on and not the IP address that, say, that person would have sent it from. But these spammers do this because they know that your email address, or in this case, your wife's email address, is a valid email address. So at some level, some spam filter might let it through saying, hey, yeah, it's coming from a valid address that's also not in a list of addresses that that we've, you know, blacklisted because of spam. And so it comes through. In the situation that you're seeing, Gray, it's being sent. Someone has sent spoofing from your wife's address to an address that no longer exists. And so the bounces, unfortunately, don't go back to the spammer. They go back to your wife because her address is listed as the from address. So that's the problem. The good news is mail servers typically fail after 5 days. That's kind of the default setting. So you'll get one email a day, perhaps from the mail server that you're trying to send it to saying, hey, I've tried. And then after 5 days, it'll say, OK, I'm going to fail permanently. So hopefully, you know, by the time you're even hearing this, the messages have stopped. But at least now you can sleep soundly knowing that there is no virus on your wife's computer blasting out these emails. So there you go. John, anything?
Yep.
Yep.
And the big fun is if you wanted to, Dave. So a little deep dive here into geekiness. If you'd like to connect to a mail server and see what this consists of. So Dave suggested that, yes, you can set your from address to anybody. But if you want to get into this for fun or just to get the low level understanding of what is happening when you send email, well, you could fire up your old pal Terminal. And now one of the utilities that are available from Terminal is Telnet. Now, Telnet is a way to do a text exchange with another computer. But the fun part is you can tell Telnet to go to other ports here. So I believe what you'd want to do is type in something like Telnet space mail dot, whatever. And then I believe it's 25, Dave.
Yeah. So you got to put a space after the server name and then connect to port 25. But a lot of a lot of ISPs, like your home ISP, will not let you connect out on port 25 to an external server. So you might need to use 587, which is sort of the alternate for 25. This kind of stuff is really difficult to talk about because without seeing it. But I did find an article on WikiHow that talks about sending email with Telnet. It uses Windows, but once you launch Terminal, it's basically the same. You're typing Telnet space and all of this stuff. So we'll put this
all
in the
I'll
show
say
notes.
Is once you initiate a SMTP session, which is with a mail server that has the ability to send something, all you have to do is type mail space from colon, and then whoever you want to be.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when SMTP, although it's a wonderful protocol and it allows billions of people to send email, the one thing they didn't put in place because they didn't think of it, because they didn't think it'd be an issue, is why would anybody want to forge the from address?
Right.
And that's the big problem. The whole problem with that is that they do no authentication to say the from address is valid. They trust you. And unfortunately, you know, back in the early days of the internet, everybody trusted that everybody was being legit and wouldn't try to forge anything. But they got that part wrong.
They did. Yeah. So. There are ways, and I don't want to get too deep into this here because I'm not sure how many of you to which it will apply, but there are ways there's this whole concept of SPF records or sender policy framework records for your domain, which basically allows you as the domain holder. So like for me, let's say with, you know, Dave the Nerd, right? I own DaveTheNerd.com and I own the company owns MacObserver.com. Right. And so we get to say, hey, these servers are valid servers to send mail from our domain. And you can, but it's up to the recipient server to say, hey, do I care about if the mail from Dave at MacObserver.com came from a server that Mac Observer says is not authorized. And if they want to follow that, then this sender policy framework thing comes into play and they can decide, yeah, okay, I want to reject that because Mac Observer says don't trust mail that doesn't come from the mail servers they've defined. So there's some of that. There's also authentication and connecting to mail servers. And, you know, the port 25 you mentioned is sort of trying to be deprecated and gone, but it'll take a long time because there's so much infrastructure that relies on it. But anyway, yeah, it's fun stuff. All right. So, you know, I wanted to talk about this iPad mini. Obviously I've been out there. I went out there and was at the event and held it for, you know, all of about 4 minutes in the well-lit, this is important, in the well-lit, perfect environment.
So you were in the media pen and they let you...
The hands-on room. That's right. Yeah. And it was good. I mean, there were...
Our hands-on room. Nice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And there's, you know, one Apple spokesperson or engineer sometimes per unit, right? So they're there to help you and explain it and stuff. But when I got this, and I am sad that I got to send it back soon, actually. But when I got it, the first thing I noticed, now remember, I've had an iPad since the day it came out, right? The very first one, I then moved to the iPad 2, I then moved to the iPad 3. I have not moved to the iPad 4. It just doesn't make sense to justify that kind of expense for something that's not going to impact me. But anyway, so I'm very, obviously very comfortable with the Retina display now, very, very accustomed to it. And the first thing I noticed with the iPad mini, and not as much in the hands-on room, but certainly at home, I took the backup from my iPad 3 and restored it onto this iPad mini and shut off my iPad 3. So it has been off for like 2 weeks. And the lack of Retina display was jarring at first. It took me about a week to get to the point where it doesn't like bother me every time that I turn it on. I still see it. I'm still very much aware of it. Doesn't help that my iPhone does have Retina and this doesn't, right? But I gotta say, the weight of this thing alone and the size, because I can hold it in one hand, is huge. Prior to the iPad, I was a Kindle user, right? I had a Kindle and I read books on my Kindle. Once I got the iPad, I moved all my books over to the Kindle app on the iPad because it was silly to have two devices. And in the last, whatever it is, 3 years, I've found that I've probably read 30% as much as I would have prior to getting the iPad. Now, I assumed that this was primarily because the iPad offers distractions, right? I have email that I can check. I have Twitter. I can look on the web. I can follow my ADD brain anywhere.
Notification center. Yay.
Yeah. Now I have notification center. Right. But I didn't even have that in the beginning, but it didn't matter. You know, I just was like nuts with stuff. And then I got this iPad mini and I obviously put books on it and I started reading, and I'm finding that I'm reading a lot more with this. And it's because it's so lightweight compared to the iPad 3. It's easy to hold in one hand, and that reading doesn't bother me. It bothers me with the iPad, you know, the larger iPad. I've got to have two hands on the thing. I've got to, you know, steady this thing, and it's just exhausting to kind of hold up. And yeah, I can sort of rest it on my chest in bed or whatever, but it's non-optimal. On the iPad mini, I find I'm reading and using it a lot in portrait mode, whereas the iPad 3 I would use mostly in landscape mode. Now I use the iPad mini in both modes, but portrait mode is sort of my default mode for this thing. And again, the weight of it, it's awesome. Now, I have been using it as my main iPad for, like I said, 2+ weeks. I have not, and this is surprising to me, I have not run into a scenario where I thought, oh, dang it, I don't have a big enough screen to do what I want to do. And honestly, I thought that what I use it for right now, which is while we do Mac Keycab, I use NoteTaker HD to bring up the agenda for the show. And then I use a little stylus pen that I have here in the office to scratch off each agenda item. It's just, it's electronic paper, right? It keeps me from printing a page and then throwing it away. But I thought, you know, that's much smaller. And so now I'm going to have to fight with, you know, the size of the screen being smaller and being more accurate with the stylus. Not an issue, not even a little bit of an issue. So, and of course the battery life on this thing is fantastic. And not having a Retina display is probably a big factor there. But I'm very excited about taking it traveling next week. And then I have to send it back as soon as I get back. But I imagine that a day will come where the iPad mini is the only iPad I carry, probably within the next year. I'm not in any great rush. We'll see how I feel after I have to give this thing back and I move back to the iPad 3. But that may change what I just said. But you know, certainly if they get to the point, like, you know, I'm going to try and hold out for Rev 2 of the iPad mini, whatever that is. My guess is it hopefully you'll have a Retina screen, but it may not. You know, they may find that at this size, they just don't want to do that. Of course, they did it with the iPhone, so I'm guessing we'll see it here. But it's fantastic. I really I'm blown away, actually. I did not expect to be we keeping you up there, John? I thought I heard you yawning. Maybe you were just drinking, having a sip. But
yes,
I did not expect to be. I did not expect to be blown away by this thing, and I really, really am. It's I had planned to use it for a week, and then I was actually going to let my wife use it for a week to get her opinion on it, because she has one on her Christmas list and hopes to get one for Christmas, and I have not had time to migrate back to my iPad 3 so that she can test this. That's an interesting data point to me that I just haven't found the time to migrate back. So it's because I don't want to. So yeah, very, very, very interesting. Yeah. Have you seen an iPad 3, or do you have any questions about what I'm doing with this here, John?
No, the gist I get is that it's a, between a iPad and a iPhone.
Yeah, it's
and it's
definitely
not Retina.
It's definitely an iPad, right? I mean, it's the iPhone is its own thing. And one thing I will say, though, is apps that, and I don't have many of these. In fact, I think I launched my first one this morning. I launched Track the Pack, which is an app I love. But just track boxes and, you know, I get push notifications and all that stuff. But there is no iPad version of it. And so I launched Track the Pack on the iPad and I zoomed it up to 2X on the mini. And it's not like grotesquely large or anything. It feels usable on this thing. And but it is definitely an iPad. It is not an iPhone. You use it more like an iPad than I use it more like an iPad than I do the phone. But it's so darn portable and easy to get around with. And yeah, I'm like I said, I'm blown away.
So. Yeah. Well, if anything, I have to consider it because, you know, relating to my complaints about iPhone battery life, I would think that this device would have a longer battery life versus an iPhone.
Oh,
but not
definitely.
As much as an iPad. So
I would say it has the same
compromise.
I would say it has the same battery life as my larger iPad. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There's enough. I mean, there's less screen in here. Right. So there doesn't need to be as much battery. So that was sort of my thinking on it. No, it lasts. I mean, my iPad, I don't measure in hours. I measure in days and this thing, I've probably been using it more, just as I've been kind of, you know, it's new and shiny and so I want to touch it more, but, you know, I've probably charged it twice in 2.5 weeks, maybe three times. I mean, it's just not, yeah, it's not an issue. So it's good. It is good. And as not allowed to chat in the app, in the chat room, I still would like to know where that comes from, but as that person points out, it looks more reasonable to use the camera on this as a video camera than it does the full size iPad. And I would,
right. Because
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Cause anybody taking pictures with an iPad, just,
it looks,
I'm
it
sorry,
look
in public, you look like a dork. I'm sorry.
No, it's just, true. It looks funny.
There's no getting around it.
Nope.
You just, it's not a camera, even though it has a camera in it.
Right.
I guess that's the problem right there.
Right.
Just got to tape over that camera, kids. All right.
Yeah. All right. We have three tips that we're going to share here. I know we're over an hour. We're almost an hour and 10, but I want to share three tips before we wrap this, up. So I'm going to go to Joe, and Joe has, he says, this is a warning. Do not, under any circumstances, press the autofill button in iTunes out of curiosity, unless you go into the settings tab of said autofill page window and choose something other than music. He says, I'm watching my entire library sync to my iPad as I write this. Imagine picking back through thousands of songs to get back to what I actually wanted on there. So the autofill button is when you have an iPod, or in this case, an iPad, right? iTunes doesn't care. And you just want to tell it, yeah, put everything there or put as much as you can fit on there. And obviously, if that's what you want, then great. But there is no warning after you click the button. It just does it and kind of forgets all of your previous settings. And there is no way to go back. So, yeah, so beware of that. I to help prevent any... to help prevent the situation that Joe's in now, I actually, for the devices that I don't just put everything on, I use playlists to manage what I put on the iPad or on the, I mean, now I use iTunes Match, but you know, like on the little iPod Nanos or whatever, I create playlists for those. And so if I did accidentally hit autofill, I could just turn that off and then say, no, only put this playlist out there. And now I'm back in business. And it's a smart playlist, or you can build it with smart playlists. And so it's helpful. So that's, but yes, good advice, Joe. I'm with you on that. Any thoughts before we go to the next tip?
Nope.
Okay. This is a little bit of a long story from Kevin, but no, it's not too bad. He says, I've been meaning to write this up for some time, but I haven't had a chance to do so until now. A while back, I tweeted that Carbon Copy Cloner had saved my bacon, and that's completely true. But the actual story is a little more convoluted, and I thought I would share it with you and your listeners. It all started when I bought a 2011 Mac Mini last May. I had previously had a 2009 Mini and had it tricked out with an SSD and 8 gigs of RAM. It was a hot machine for a Core 2 Duo Mini. When I bought the new Mac, I immediately went to my local computer parts store and bought some discounted RAM that fit the OS specs required for the new Mac. I also bought and installed a new SSD, replacing the original 5400 drive. For some time, I had no problems. Suddenly, though, I began having problems with kernel panics. I couldn't find a common denominator until I pulled up Disk Utility and ran Disk First Aid against the SSD. Sure enough, there was severe corruption. As I stated at the time, I had my SSD backing up on a daily basis to a USB drive using Carbon Copy Cloner. I also use Time Machine, but as you've pointed out many times, it is useless for getting a computer up and running again quickly. I booted the Mac from the clone, repaired the internal drive. Not but a day later, I came up with the same problem again. Luckily, I had disconnected the good external drive in anticipation that the problem would recur. I rebooted the Mac Mini using the external drive, and this time I wiped the internal drive and copied the external drive contents over to the SSD again. Again, I disconnected the external drive and ran the computer for just a few hours before the problem surfaced yet again. Yep, I had an old copy of Drive Genius, so I upgraded it to version 3 and used it to analyze the SSD. I also reran the firmware loader for the SSD to make sure it had the proper firmware. Nothing was found, and so I finally got around to running Apple hardware test. The diagnosis? The RAM was faulty. All of that because I bought cheap RAM. Luckily, I kept the receipt and took the RAM back and exchanged it for some crucial memory that cost, I think, about $5 more. Problem solved, and it has not come back since. I learned the hard way that cheap RAM isn't worth the few dollars you might save. And that, listening to your advice about having a bootable backup, is worth more than you can imagine. Yeah, indeed. Thanks for the story, Kevin. That's it's true. The good thing is you bought RAM from a reputable vendor, right? Your local store in this case, but it could be true online as well. RAM does go bad sometimes, even RAM from known manufacturers. So it may be that your RAM was just fine and it shorted out, or it may be that it was sort of faulty from the beginning. But being able to get, if you can buy RAM that has a lifetime warranty, and all RAM should come with a lifetime warranty. If you can't find that from the vendor you're looking at, look elsewhere, because most vendors will give you a lifetime warranty on RAM. And sometimes you have to use it. And that's just how it goes. Good story. Kernel panics are often the result of bad RAM. Not always, but that's one of the things that certainly pops up on the list when you have recurring kernel panics. So thoughts on that, Mr. Brown?
And it's annoying. Get the pipe ready. So the floodgates. So I did find an article. So I did find a Apple support article, which you can always find at support.apple.com/KB. And then the article number HT1651, how to remove or install memory on your MacBook. One of the things I would point out is that there are many flavors of RAM and not all of them work in all machines. So one thing is that this support article will tell you the specific, and you want to follow every part of the specification, is the type of RAM, the size, the number of pins, and maybe the error correction technology, because there are error correction technologies in memory that may or may not work with a Mac or another computer, be it a Mac or a PC, because they're not equipped to understand or handle it. So, as I think we implied, you want to make sure to get RAM from a vendor that understands or claims to support the Mac. So if you do get RAM that is not quite the right type, you can return it. The other thing, Dave, I hope you have this off the top of your head, but there is a utility on the Mac. I think it's a Unix command line thing that will test the...
Called Memtest.
Memtest, which is a more thorough memory test than Apple hardware test is a good start. So that's a utility that is, as you may know, is included probably on the boot DVD, or you may have to hold down a special key, but it's usually on the disk that come with your computer, something called Apple hardware test, or you may be able to invoke it by holding down something like H, think, on some older Macs.
I thought it was
Macs. D for diagnostics, and it would boot the Apple hardware test, and then it would run, and it would say, and actually the thing, if you are concerned about memory test, it would come up and say, hey, you want me to do a express test or a really, you know, deep test? And the deep test, if anything, will detect the RAM errors. So
yeah, mem test, just to clarify in case it wasn't clear, that is not installed by default on your Mac. You have to install it. Applejack would put it on there, and you can also just go get it directly, and we'll put a link in the show notes about Memtest. But yeah. No, Memtest is good. I like that. It allows you to test more of your RAM than any other utility. So all right. One last one, John, that we actually wrote up on TMO this week because I hadn't seen anybody else talk about it, but USB 3 can cause Wi-Fi and Bluetooth interference. And there's actually a white paper from Intel about this, and Apple's USB 3 FAQ also says it, that some USB 3 devices, specifically USB hard drives, can generate radio frequency interference that can cause Wi-Fi and Bluetooth devices operating in the 2.4 gigahertz band to have issues communicating with your computer. Do not place hard drives or other USB devices behind the rear of your Mac near the hinge of your screen. And the antennas for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth are located there, and USB 3 devices placed there may interfere with your wireless connections. So the idea is to get your, especially hard drives, away from the back of your Mac. And I think, you know, even just a foot or two, putting it off to the side or what have you, it should help mitigate some of that. But very interesting. I had not heard about this before. But like I said, there's white papers, and you know, it's not a phony baloney problem. It's the real deal. In fact, Brad, who sent this in to us, said his dad had this affect him recently. Brad says, I thought it was a faulty wireless mouse, but it turned out to be his new USB 3 external hard drive. Try figuring that one out during troubleshooting. Yeah. That's so hopefully we've saved at least somebody else out there from, you know, scratching their head and saying this wouldn't possibly cause any trouble. But in fact, it does.
Oh, my God.
I know.
You know, I'm just scratching my head over this because it's the kind I don't know. It's the kind of thing you'd look for. It's like, gee, should we make a technology that causes radiation in a band that is already used by lots of other devices like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth? Yeah, sure.
I know. It's crazy.
I don't know. I just don't get this. I mean, they were probably using parts that were common with other computer implementations of wireless or whatever, but it's like, or you know, bus technologies, but it's like, did anybody check that? I find the whole story perplexing because you would think that somebody would have figured this out before releasing it to the public at large. Oh, by the way, you know, our new USB 3 clobbers your 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi. It's like, what?
Yeah,
I don't get it.
It's crazy.
But we heard about it, and others have. So
yeah.
Warning.
Yeah, warning. That's right. All right. Well, I think it's time, John. As we said,
for what?
This will be the next show that we do will be on December 9th. So
next month?
That's right.
Gosh.
Yeah, that will be. It will be the first show of December.
I don't know if I can handle this.
Yeah, you get the week off, John, as do I.
Well, no, I don't. Well, from you.
From this. Yeah, it's good.
No, from you.
Yeah, that's right. You get the week off from me. I see. Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes.
How to contact us. You always want to know about this. So I'll start. There's email, Dave. You can email us at feedback@macgeekab.com.
feedback@macgeekab.com is the way to email us. It's an awesome way to email us.
And I will triple that. feedback@macgeekab.com. But that's not the only email address. There is another one, Dave, that I've heard of recently through rumors and innuendo. premium at MacGeekApp.com.
That's right. Premium at MacGeekApp.com is reserved for those of you that are our premium subscribers. Premium is set up primarily, frankly, to help you, to allow you to support the show directly if you choose to do so. MacGeekApp.com/premium has all of the details about this. You can check this out. We have, there's essentially three ways that you can contribute. Number one is you can do what the plan that we've always had, which is $25 every 6 months. There is also a $10 a month plan. And that may seem strange. You may say, well, why would I want to do one versus the other? And I'll explain. Then there's also a one-time donation of any amount that you would like to make. Now you ask, why would you have different amounts? Well, first of all, you asked for them, so we've provided them. But there's also a little bit of incentive and thanks. For every $100 that you donate, and it could be $100 all at once, and we've certainly had several of you do that, and we very much appreciate it, or it could be $100 over the course of, say, 2 years. But once you hit that $100 threshold, and each time you hit that $100 threshold, you are eligible to receive whatever the next gift is that we send out. And we'll, like I said, we'll probably be doing these sometime mid-December. We'll be kind of closing the window, the current window, and then sending these gifts out to all of you. No matter where you are in the world, we will make sure to include you on this. It is our way of saying thanks and taking a little bit of that that you send us and putting it back towards you. Obviously, the point of premium is frankly to help support the show financially, and so most of the money actually does go to John and I for various things, stuff we need for the show, and then also, you know, helps us pay our mortgages, and that is very much appreciated because we like to do this every week. So that's premium, and you get to email premium at MacGeekGab.com. That is actually probably the biggest benefit of this. That is a prioritized email address that you have access to when you're a premium subscriber, as long as your subscription is active. So there you go. Did I explain that well, John?
I think you said premium at MacGeekGab.com, Dave. Just want to make sure I got that.
I did that. That's right.
Good. All right. Outstanding. Yes.
You can call us. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number to call us.
4335. You can also, we are on the Twitters. So, I am John F. Ron. He is Dave Hamilton. The guy in the sky is Pilot Pete.
He's actually in the chat room at the moment.
Oh, he is.
He is.
Oh,
hi, goodness.
Pete. Hi, Pete. Oh, I see him there. The show is MacGeekApp, and the publication, virtual as it is Mac Observer. So, all those Twitter things. But not only do you get that, Dave, you also get Facebook. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
So, Facebook. If you go to Facebook.com and you went to Facebook.com/MacGeekGab, you probably find the Facebook account for the show.
I think you would find the Facebook account for the show. There is one last way you can contact us that I can think of at the moment.
No way.
Yeah, and that's the MacGeekGab iOS app. Go ahead and check that out. We will put a link, of course, in the show notes. But it not only allows you to contact us, you can send, if you're a premium member, it'll route you to the premium queue. But you can send email, you can send audio comments. And if you're listening to the show at the moment that you choose to contact us, it will actually tag it with the chapter and the timestamp of the show you were in, so that we know what you're talking about, or, you know, where you were, especially if it's in reference to something you heard in the show. Now, though, the app, we just added the ability to hear the live stream. And there's been some bugs with that. But of course, Corey is working on those, and with the help of many of you, actually figuring out those bugs. And I think he's got them licked. So hopefully we'll push another version of the app out in the not too distant future here to resolve that. So, yeah, check out the MacGeekGab app. We would appreciate it. John, I think that's it. Right? Anything else?
You think?
I think we're good. So I want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He puts all of the chapterizing into our shows here, and we very much appreciate that. And of course, we want to thank the folks from CashFly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen for iPhone, iPad, and your Mac from Smile, and of course, Gazelle.com to send all your stuff back that you and get money for your old stuff. I just did that actually earlier tonight. Check it all out. John, before we take 2 weeks off, there's got to be something that you want to share with everyone that's listening here.
You betcha.
It's the season
Don't
of...
Don't get caught!
Made up.